are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder, where every day's casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday, Tuesday, casual Tuesday, Wednesday, casual hump day, Thursday, casual Thurs, that's what we call it, and Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Friday, March 8th, 2019. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Ben Dixon, host and proprietor of the Benjamin Dixon Show. Also on the program today, Paul Manafort gets 46 months in the clink. And that's just his first sentence, ladies and gentlemen. Part two coming up shortly. Meanwhile, Donald Trump turns out to have hosted the former owner of the sex trafficking massage parlor where Bob Kraft got busted. Coincidence.
Thick tugs. Thick tugs. I didn't start anything with the wife.
Democrats in the House pass one of the largest voting and ethics reform bills maybe in decades. And 23 Republicans vote against a resolution condemning hate. Meanwhile, the Pentagon asked to warehouse up to 5,000 detained migrant children as the White House plans to drain military pensions to build the wall. Elizabeth Warren releases a plan to break up Amazon, Google, and Facebook. Does it involve prison sentences for under the Sherman Act, but still pretty good. Mitch McConnell prepping a new nuclear option to speed up confirmation of right-wing judges. No word yet if it involves blowing up the moon and having its pieces fall into Lake Michigan. And someone in the White House is leaking stuff about Ivanka to Democratic investigative committees. And lastly, Chelsea Manning sent to jail for refusing to testify in the U.S. Government's WikiLeaks case. All this and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining us. Another week has passed. I don't know what to tell you. We are still here, barely.
We did it.
It's amazing in this era, but a week goes by and it feels like we were on vacation like 6 years ago.
Yeah, I feel that way. And I was on vacation last weekend.
Like this week, actually.
Yeah. up until Monday.
Up until Tuesday. Well, let's not get technical about these things, folks. But nevertheless, yes, it's another crazy. No, I'm not kidding. It's all just about accuracy. I'm trying to make a point. But another crazy week, and it's going to get worse, folks. Let me just touch on this McConnell thing, because sometimes stories like this get lost, and certainly. I'm not going to go into a long diatribe about Jimmy Dore or other people who are just not bright enough to understand the implications of having a Republican executive in office in a Republican-controlled Senate. There's not going to be any legislation that gets passed over the next 2 years, 18 months, 2 years, that is going to be particularly horrific. There may be some corporatist ones that get passed that do so with a little fanfare that we may not like. But there's not going to be any huge tax cuts for the wealthy again. There's not going to be a rollback of the ACA, although it will happen administratively in some sectors. There's not going to be cuts to Medicare. There's not going to be cuts to Social Security. There's not going to be Social Security privatization. However, what has happened in the Senate and will continue to happen in the Senate, and at a pace that is even greater than it's been, will be the wholesale monopolization of the far right of our judiciary for decades to come. Decades to come. If we are extremely lucky, the worst that will happen from the about the Supreme Court from now until 2020 will be that a 70-some-odd-year-old conservative is replaced by a 45-year-old conservative. So that seat will not come up for grabs for another 30 years. And if you look at the conservatives on the court, that majority of five will be there until I am probably too old to speak into this microphone and be legible and understood. Huge missed opportunity, obviously, with the Garland thing. I mean, it wasn't, you know, putting aside that Garland was not the pick that I would have chosen. But Kennedy and maybe Thomas is, I would imagine Thomas is going to announce his resignation pretty soon. That would be my guess.
Yeah.
They're going to want to get him out of the way. Although McConnell may not, it certainly will not slow things down because it's, you know, 9 months till an election, whatever it is. But Roberts is probably going to be the next out unless something tragic happens and one of the four on the left side of the court, I guess, the liberal side of the court, has to resign. And even these four are not, you know, they are to the right of nearly everyone who sat on that court supposedly in the left seats 30 years ago. But nevertheless, the other aspect of the judiciary is not just the Supreme Court. It is the Federal Court of Appeals in various districts, circuits around the country. And Trump has filled these spots at a pace that is completely unprecedented, at least in the last, I don't know, four or five presidents, so 30, 40 years at least. And they are as radical as maybe we've seen in the modern era. They are much more reminiscent of justices that we would have seen in the 1890s, let's say, or the early 1900s. Who viewed such things as Social Security as unconstitutional. I mean, these people are extremely radical. They come in slightly different flavors. Some are convinced that we are now living in a full-on socialistic, communistic state. Others think that we're living in too profound, profane of a world, and they're theocrats. But they're all extremely radical on the conservative end. And what Mitch McConnell has done is he got rid of the filibuster when it came to the Supreme Court justices, completely predictable, although some people thought it was equivalent to the moon falling in Lake Michigan. Completely predictable. And Mitch McConnell also got rid of blue slips, which was a rule that basically said a senator from any given state could basically refuse to give their sign-off for a judicial nominee in that circuit that includes their state and prevent a lot of justice judges from sitting on that court. The Republicans used this throughout the Obama administration, repeatedly, kept a lot of judges off the court. McConnell no longer recognizes that practice. The latest reporting is that McConnell will now invoke a new nuclear option by reducing the amount of time for debate over district-level judicial nominees from 30 hours to 2. So one of the ways that Democrats have tried to slow McConnell's role here, and particularly since Chuck Schumer was basically told, I think, by his caucus, you got to stop making these deals that allow all of them to walk through, that they would require 30 hours of debate. And, you know, 30 hours of debate, it's not from this morning at 10 a.m. till tomorrow at 4 p.m. It is 30 hours in which the Senate is in session. And on any given week, there may only be 30 hours of session time period. Probably, I don't know, maybe even less. And so this slows the pace in which judges can be confirmed. However, if you change the rules, which McConnell can do with a simple majority vote, that will basically just make it the path to confirming all these much easier. So this is going to be, you know, highly problematic for my kids. That's well, how long the impact of this is going to be.
As far as I'm concerned, court packing should be a question asked of every single presidential candidate right now.
The problem is, I mean, yeah, and Eric Holder actually came out in favor of that today. I mean, I think ultimately court packing will bring about hopefully some reform with the Supreme Court on 18 years. But there's just, it's unlikely, and it's possible, the Senate could add, you know, to the circuit courts around the country. Certainly the Republicans were trying to reverse that. They, in during the Obama administration, they tried to eliminate three positions on the D.C. Circuit Court so that Republicans could maintain their parity with the number of Democrats on there, because there was three or four vacancies. It's conceivable that in this, but it's not just for presidents, right? This would be for Democratic senators. Will you vote to expand the number of judges on these circuit courts? But, you know, it becomes... You're opening a can of worms. I mean, the best thing to do is to win elections consistently over time, and make sure that you have the ability to vote for these you know, to confirm these judicial nominees. And frankly, the left does a very bad job because they don't seem to understand the importance of the judiciary, as exemplified by people who poo-poo it. There is nothing akin to the Federalist Society in terms of basically training and reproducing these judicial candidates and providing on day one the president with a list. Here's 50 people who should be getting, you know, the first 50 circuit court or district court appointees. And here's a list of people on the Supreme Court. I mean, it is just simply that the left, broadly speaking, doesn't take this stuff terribly seriously. I think that's going to change over the next 15, 20 years when they start to realize, like, nothing we pass.
Oh, it's changing now, I think, already.
I think there are plenty of people on the left who take it seriously. I think there are structural barriers to it, and maybe some people didn't take it as seriously as they should have, but it's, like, more complex than that.
But it takes, you know, I mean, people can say, I take it seriously, but it takes literally, you know, decades to build an infrastructure. And when Cenk Uygur was a young lawyer 25 years ago, I think he was a member of the Federalist Society, right? Like, there is no equivalent on the left. And I'm not just talking about, you know, voters or the commentariat, also, like, institutionally, there needs to be more appreciation on the left of the judiciary. That will happen. It's going to take 10 years from now when we have, you know, President
Ilhan Omar.
Ilhan Omar trying to, you know.
She is the new stand-in. I don't care, by the way, if whatever the amendment is that bars her, but she's my new ideal stand-in.
Right.
It's no longer AOC.
Right.
It's President Ilhan Omar.
Okay.
Yeah, we'll change the rules.
Whoever it is as president there, when they start to pass the, you know, the Sharia laws and the.
That's what I've been working for.
The court says you can't pass the, you know, that this is unconstitutional. That's when I think you're going to see a lot more activity.
We pack the court so we can implement Sharia.
Right.
Nice.
Right.
Yeah, well,
awesome.
Court packing and term limits are two shorter term solutions to the damage that's been done to the judiciary.
I'm importing the Grand Mufti from Egypt.
All the options on the
table. All right. Let's turn to this before we get to Ben Dixon. I have to tell you that I know there are times where I don't get too emotional in situations like this, but I found this really moving. Meghan McCain has been taking Ilhan Omar's comments, and it has been really devastating for her.
Can I just ask before we do this?
We know all the things that are said and go back and forth. And Meghan has been really, really strong, you know, throughout this entire period where we have seen such an increase in hate groups and in physical violence and by the right. And she has been a real trooper. But this,
she's never prevaricated. I mean, any single instance, whether it's Trump or whether it's an incident,
I'm just saying that
in public,
she's been totally consistently
100% opposed to all forms of bigotry.
And but she's just hit her limit with what's happened with Ilhan Omar.
Let me just finish. When we had Barry Weiss on as an expert in what is anti-Semitic and what isn't, I asked her, is it okay to talk about Israel's policies and not be called anti-Semitic?
And she said yes.
She said where it crosses the line is when you say that Israel does not have the right to exist. That is when it crosses the line. Now, Omar has never suggested that Israel does not have the right to exist.
But can I say what she has said?
So, to me, it seems to me that Republicans are trying to use this as a wedge issue.
I'm really not.
And I think that...
Not you. I'm not talking about you.
You know, this selective outrage is kind of crazy because I don't think that the Republicans have moral high ground here.
But it seems like Democrats are upset.
I think that Kevin McCarthy has used these anti-Semitic tropes. I think that Jim Jordan just recently, tweeted this
against Tom Steyer.
Remember that Ilhan Omar in the West Virginia Republican Party just had this huge poster superimposed with her face with 9/11 terrorists. And I haven't heard any outrage about that coming from the Republican Party. This selective outrage, and I will tell you, I take this very personally as a woman of color who has, you know, been the subject of so much bigotry. And what a lot of people don't know is that my grandfather is Jewish. He is a Sephardic Jew. And so I have, you know, my family members have received a lot of bigotry. I've experienced firsthand in my family anti-Semitism and bigotry for being black. And so I think it's just a distraction.
All right, pause it for 1 second. That is Sonny Hostin, who is now like my favorite daytime talk show.
You are such a relentless self-hating Jew.
Comfortable with me speaking now?
You got to go back. Because So Meghan is trying to interrupt Sonny throughout this, and she can't. And even Abby Huntsman was trying to interrupt Sonny throughout this, and she can't. Sonny just like blew through her. And so I have a feeling the fact that Meghan was, you know, feels ganged up on by Joy and Sonny. I mean, this is so silly that we're talking about this, but millions of people get their perspective on these things through this. I mean, the View is so much more effective in getting a political message across than this program that it is impossible for me to even contemplate. So this stuff is relevant. And so Sonny and Joy are basically, taking the lead here. And I think that's as much of a reason why Meghan McCain gets so emotional here than anything else. Watch this.
And so I just think it's just a distraction. Are you comfortable with me speaking now?
She also said Israel has hypnotized the world, suggested that Jews in Israel have bought U.S. politicians all about the Benjamins, mm-hmm. implied that American Jews have divided loyalties, and it's okay for people to push
allegiance to it. None of this is true. The only thing she did say was that Israel has hypnotized the world. And I would take issue with the word hypnotized, because really what they have done is sent out squads of former Mossad agents in private organizations to change and to intimidate, literally to intimidate people who critique Israel in this country. That's not hypnosis. In many respects, it's worse. And this is something that she tweeted in 2012, deleted and apologized for. And frankly, I got to tell you, like, it may be inappropriate language for a congressperson, because you're in a, you know, like, I tell my son, hey, we're at a restaurant, don't keep talking about your penis, because not that there's anything wrong with your penis, but just like, it's just there are things that are more appropriate in other situations. At home, you can talk about it with me if you want.
Yeah, English is like her third language. Well, so it's not on her if she didn't know the association with that word.
But even if she meant it as she did, the reality is we know that there is, and I personally know this, and I mentioned this the other day, like, you know, Israel is extremely aggressive in dealing with their critics, and you know, from whether I was on a radio show and I get contacted from the Israeli embassy the next day I critique Israel, or whether they're sending out former Mossad agents to harass people, and this is all well documented. I mean, there was a story this past week in it. So, yeah. But everything else she says about the dual loyalties and referring to Jews simply did not happen. This is getting your news from the Daily Caller and their interpretation of what she said.
Allegiance to a foreign country. I again say, why this obsession with Jerusalem and Israel? Why this obsession with this specific area of the country? And as you said,
pause it. She also is a huge critic of Saudi Arabia, which Meghan McCain doesn't know, because Meghan McCain has done nothing except for read the Daily Caller about this.
As you said, as you've said many times, these are dog whistle comments for Jewish Americans.
Yes,
they are.
We agree.
And they hear what she's saying. And she has to apologize for that. You have to admit,
Megan, that it is disingenuous of the Republican Party to go after her. This is her point, when they are backing a president who is in bed with dictators committing human rights violations really all over the world.
It's in bigotry.
Let's go there.
So just really quickly, since we're talking about, I take this very personally. I would go so far as to say I probably verge on being a Zionist as well. But I will say that I don't have family that is Jewish, but Joe Lieberman and Hadassah Lieberman are my family.
Yeah.
And I take the hate crimes rising in this country incredibly seriously, and I think what's happening in Europe is really scary. And I'm sorry if I'm getting emotional,
but you're right.
The idea that this is politicized, I'm really not. I was very nervous to talk about this on the show because I thought it would become politicized, and it really shouldn't be. On both sides, it should be called out.
Right.
And just because I don't technically have Jewish family that are blood related to me, it doesn't mean I don't take this as seriously, and it is very dangerous. Very dangerous. And I think we all collectively as Americans on both sides, and what Ilhan Omar is saying is very scary to me, and it's very scary to a lot of people, and I don't think you have to be Jewish to recognize
that.
You
don't.
And I just hope, instead of a resolution just from the Democrats, I'm tired of the selective outrage, and I hope that we have a joint resolution, perhaps, from Republicans and from the Democrats. I would be in favor of a joint resolution.
Well, just actually, because I'm not Jewish doesn't mean I can't do fake outrage and ridiculous crass identity politics. Incidentally, I have to say, to defend the Jewish people, you pick two of the worst Jewish people in human history. Joe and Hadassah Lieberman are your doorway
to
Jewish.
They're completely out of the mainstream of Jewish thought.
They're
in this
marginal
country.
In Jewish thought.
And so you don't have to be Jewish to be outraged at Ilhan Omar's comments. And actually, it's probably a liability to that end, because I am quite confident, and we haven't seen any polling, but I am quite confident that the majority of Jews in this country are not concerned with her comments.
Well, I also have to say, too, in addition to how disgusting and fake that came off to me, and how, of course, Joe Lieberman is not helping your case, I'm going to go back to Hillary Clinton, Chelsea Clinton's trash, disgusting tweets about Ilhan Omar lecturing her on not only anti-Semitism, but actually citizenship in this country a couple of weeks ago. And so, like, what is it with trust fund baby children of prominent politicians who had everything handed to them, impugning the integrity and patriotism of somebody who came from a refugee camp to be in Congress, who has worked more hard and is more self-made in an afternoon than they are in a lifetime? It's disgusting.
No, she poses a threat to the bipartisan neoconservative foreign policy consensus. Therefore, she's very dangerous to them. And, you know, they're going to use whatever underhanded means they can to silence her.
I also think Meghan McCain is the married to the head of the Federalist, which maybe doesn't have the same weepy relationship to Joe Lieberman.
Yeah, here's a couple of just headlines from the Federalist. Steve Bannon isn't anti-Semitic because Jewish girls are whiny.
Wow, that's kind of funny. I'm sorry.
It's not only funny; it's also true. But I would say that, you know, again, what's great about this is, like, these are people that, first of all, Republicans spend all day either just denying actual acts of racism or any other form of bigotry. Or if they're Meghan McCain and they want plausible deniability, they pretend that something isn't there. And now all of a sudden they can impugn subtlety when it comes to her.
All right. We've got to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Ben Dixon. Right back.
Infrastructure, no bumps in the road.
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. And just a reminder, folks, you can support this program by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. Jointhemajorityreport.com for just a couple of bucks a week. You get the bonus show and you support this free show. And on the phone, speaking of show, the proprietor and host of the Benjamin Dixon Show, Ben Dixon. Welcome to the program, Ben.
Hey, Sam, thanks so much for having me, man. It's always a pleasure.
Always a pleasure to talk to you as we look back on this week. I guess the big news, obviously, yesterday. And there's two things. I mean, we were just talking about the Ilhan Omar situation, which ended, I think, fairly well, relatively speaking, for the Democrats insofar as they ended up passing a bill against hate, which is always, you know, nice sentiment. 23 Republicans found it inappropriate to to speak out against bigotry and discrimination, but I guess that's the way they roll. But the biggest problem for me with the whole Ilhan Omar stuff is that it stepped all over the passage today of H.R. 1, which is a great bill and should be, you know, has the whole host of, first off, it is one of those things where it's hugely important for democracy to make these reforms. And it's also something, a structural change, because we know the more democracy you have, the better the Democrats do. This is something they should have always done, and it should be SR1 in 2021 if the Democrats take the Senate as well. Give me your sense of this bill. We can go through it a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, there are some key components to this bill that progressives we've been screaming for some time.
Yep.
The national holiday, the automatic registration, exposing and an attempt to get rid of dark money. I hadn't really thought about the way you framed it there with the Ilhan Omar issue kind of treading on this, because this is a significant win. Mind you, I mean, it's not going anywhere. Mitch McConnell has made that clear already. And of course, even by some miracle, it passed the Senate. Donald Trump is not going to sign it. Even though he did run on draining the swamp, and this bill actually is a move in the right direction, even for his false promise. But here we are. I mean, this is an opportunity for Democrats and progressives to signal what 2020 will actually look like. And I think that's the biggest takeaway from this, is like, we can show America that once Democrats get back in power, ostensibly, they will move forward with this type of campaign reform.
Yeah, this thing, you mentioned that it makes a federal holiday of voting. So only federal workers would get off, but there would be an option mm-hmm. for private in the private sector. It would mm-hmm. provide same day registration, 15 days of early voting across the board. This is something, you know, to have this stuff standardized.
Right.
It would provide automatic or online registration.
Right.
It would deal with the what do they call it, the caging, where they would crack down on efforts to jump people off the rolls. It would mm-hmm. require paper ballots. It would reinvigorate the Voting Rights Act, which got decimated by the Supreme Court. Campaign finance, enhance the Disclose Act. It would do a new matching fund program. There's a whole host of ethics things too, like release your tax returns. You can't serve on corporate boards if you're in the House. You can't use taxpayer money to pay penalties for employment discrimination. Supreme Court would get a code of ethics, which is absurd that it doesn't now, but
right.
you know, you have someone like
right.
Thomas and his wife
exactly. Yep.
And it would deal with foreign and domestic lobbying. I mean, this is all good stuff.
Yeah, I mean, it's unquestionably good. I'm actually to be honest with you, I am a little shocked at how robust it is, and perhaps it's robust because it doesn't have a chance of passing. Because
right.
let's be real, there's things in there that obviously Democrats have benefited from. But I think I think if we look at it through an optimistic lens, I think the powers that be on the Democratic side have to realize that even though they benefit from some of these things, the Republican Party has disproportionately benefited from all the things that they're trying to address in H.R. 1. And so that's looking at it optimistically. I think the best that we can do is invigorate the various bases. Like there's components in here that should resonate with Republicans if we weren't in such a hyper-partisan era. But I think this bill really could be something that will invigorate the frustrated base that just feels like that this is all rigged. Well, here's a piece of legislation that literally addresses some of the most critical components of our broken system.
Right. I mean, one of the things that Donald Trump ran on, right, was this idea of like, I'm not going to have to take their money because I got my own money.
Yeah.
And that was something that, you know, we forget about this. But as you're saying that, I remember, like, you know, so many news stories were about how people were like, he is not going to be subject to big
right,
money.
Right.
And to have a 6-to-1 matching funds mm-hmm. for you know, federal elections, that goes a long way to balancing out the funding from supposedly all those millionaires and billionaires that Donald Trump had convinced his voters, you know, was bad for them. And
right.
This theoretically should be something that Congress people, that people in the House, when they're running against their Republican opponents, can sell to constituents. And I also had like statehood for Washington, D.C. also in this bill. So it's a whole host of things like that, that, like you say, if Republicans, you know, Republicans are never going to sign on to any of this. But the real question is, how much of this is, you know, just good for democracy, and how much of it is good for Democrats structurally, and how much of this is good in terms of a wedge issue? And they're all in there in this bill.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. And the hilarious part of this is it's like it's sad as you have to laugh for not crying. Mitch McConnell labeling this a socialist agenda. And I'm like, we quite literally, I mean, never mind the misnomer and the misuse of the phrase, but just these are things that are healthy for democracy. Right. These are things that are unquestionably healthy, making it more accessible for people to vote, easier for people to vote, to get money out of politics as much as we possibly can. I mean, literally anything that is not beneficial to the Republican Party now has been reduced to being socialism. And thankfully, that word doesn't have as much thing as it used to, but it just shows a level of desperation in terms of how would they publicly, of course they can stop it, right? But how do they publicly address an agenda this progressive and this beneficial to the common person? Well, they just have to use some common scare tactics.
Yeah, and apparently Udall is going to introduce a version of this in the Senate, and it's going to be interesting to see, because you know how Democrats use this on the 2020 campaign trail, both in the presidential election and in the House races again, because in the presidential election, you know, one of the themes that Elizabeth Warren has started to hit, seems to me, from what I've just read on the campaign trail, is the corruption, right? Like, you know, she is running in many respects similar thematically to Bernie Sanders, but within the context of the problem isn't necessarily wholesale. You know, like, I don't think Bernie is running saying like a full on, you know, we got to get rid of capitalism campaign. Right. But the Warren more explicitly is saying our capitalism is broken because of corruption. And a huge portion of this are these anti-corruption measures, you know, so you can't get a Chris Collins going around saying like, I've made 4 billion, you know, millionaires in Congress and bragging about it. And, you know, sitting on boards, I mean, people coming in and using the government as simply an extension of their business interests. And so it's going to resonate on both those levels. I don't know. I was just very pleased with the way they constructed this bill.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I'm actually shocked. Again, I usually come to these conversations quite skeptical, but I guess I am still coming quite skeptical. But I'm shocked. It made a lot of the things that are in there, I'm surprised that are in there. But I mean, let's take a win and run with it and just run up the scoreboard and all the way to 2020, because I think this is going to be a really strong tool for candidates running in 2020.
Yeah. I mean, I was just reading a piece where Max Rose, who is the Staten Island Democrat who ran as being like, you know, a pox on both their houses type of guy. And he is excited about this bill because and certainly, you know, if you can get a Democrat who is, I don't want to say conservative, but who is, you know, sort of like that. I don't want to say, you know, there's a slight right wing, you know, independence quality to him. Right. And maybe that's a little bit of an overstatement. But when you have a Democrat like that who feels strongly that they can run on this bill, then you've really hit a bill that can that crosses the gamut. And, you know, I don't know what's going to come out of all of these hearings and whatnot, but it is clear that the Democrats, because now they have the opportunity to actually investigate this stuff, the idea of corruption is going to get, because I don't know if, you know, Donald Trump is a Manchurian candidate, but I certainly know that he's corrupt. And the level of corruption that we have seen throughout the administration has been unprecedented. And Manafort's going to prison for at least 47 months as of the, you know, sentencing hearing number one because of corruption, right? I mean, just the tax evasion, whatnot. What was your take on that sentencing?
You know, I have a little bit of ambivalence about that sentence. I'm not one to champion the justice system giving maximum sentences for obvious reasons. But at the same time, 4 years seemed like quite a slap on the wrist for Manafort. Granted, he's like, what is he, 67 years old? So it's going to be a really hard 4 years for him at that age in prison. But I just felt like that judge really gave this guy too much of the benefit of the doubt, saying, what was this phrase? Prior to this, he had a pristine life or something to that effect. No, he didn't. Right. That's the whole point. You know, you don't just stumble into fraud. You don't stumble into tax evasion. Like, this was a lifestyle for him. And the second part of it is that if this is the sentence that came down, I think we talked about this back in December. This was one of the opportunities for America to have a sense of closure and justice around this entire election. You know, you have like Manafort. You had I can't think of the. What is it? The former national security advisor he had.
Flynn.
You had Flynn. You have all these guys who actually are like extremely high level, close to Trump. And my thesis back in December was, well, if we aren't getting justice with these guys, because I don't feel like 4 years is justice. If we aren't getting justice with these guys, then we sure as hell better have some justice lined up for someone higher up than Flynn, higher up than Manafort was, namely the president of the United States. So there's some really strong opportunities that I think for plea deals, I think for cooperation, obviously, that we are missing the opportunity for that national closure, because there's so much spin around this. There's so much there's so many conversations, like 24-hour news cycle about Russia. And while these charges weren't connected to Russia, you know, it's still within that framework. You know what I mean? So I really do hope that that there's some justice coming down the street for America in general, because if not, we are missing the opportunities right now with Michael Flynn. We're missing the opportunities right now with a person like Paul Manafort, who got 4 years for something most. I mean, how many years? What was I forgot the maximum sentence that he could have gotten, but
it was 19.
Like they went with the minimum.
I think it was something like the standards of you know, like sort of the, I guess the what do they call it? It's been a long week, folks. The guideline range is 19 to 24 years.
Come on, I mean, that's crazy.
I mean, here's the problem, right? Like, we have, and the way you fix this isn't necessarily sending Paul Manafort to jail for 24 years at age, you know, 69.
Yeah.
But that woman who accidentally voted she wasn't allowed to because she was on probation, she got 5 years.
Right.
For accidentally voting, or I should say voting thinking that she was allowed to. And she got 5 years. And people are tweeting out, like, you know, a myriad of these examples. And so put aside whether Paul Manafort should have gotten more time. OK, because I do think 4 years, if he serves 4 years, and who knows how much he actually serves at age 69, that's a pretty harsh and ignoble way to end your life, essentially, or to start the beginning of the end of your life. But, you know, there was you referenced that point about his otherwise blameless life.
Yeah.
And Franklin Foer at The Atlantic put together the best sort of like rebuttal to this, I think, or at least the most poetic. And he started every paragraph with, in an otherwise blameless life, he produced a public relations campaign to convince Washington that Ukrainian President Viktor Yanukovych was acting within his democratic rights and duties when he imprisoned his most compelling rival for power, or when his police killed 130 protests in the Maidan, or that he walked away from $20 million debt to a Russian oligarch, or he put his protege in the pro-Trump super PAC to funnel money to him to pay off a debt, or when he was found guilty of tax evasion on industrial scale, or when he lied to investigators and lied when he took the plea deal, or when he tried to phone a potential witness in his trial to alter his stories. I mean, when he went on and with in the 80s, when he went on to, you know, work with a Roger Stone in a, you know, a lobbying outfit that helped develop racist memes against Democrats, or when he worked, you know, sort of to help regimes that were involved in atrocities all through the 80s. I mean, that's a pretty blameful life. I mean, I guess, you know, like, yeah. I'm just trying to think of, like, you know, what it would take. But that seems to be a weird, you know, it's one thing for the guy to, you know, the judge to come up and say, I think that, you know, we're too harsh as, you know, providing penalties. But of course, this judge also has a record. Yeah, go ahead. You probably know the details better than I do.
Yeah, no, this is the same judge. T.S. Ellis III, who sentenced William Jefferson from Louisiana to 13 years for his corruption. You remember famously the guy with $90,000 in the freezer that the FBI had been tracking. So, you know, what's this change of heart in terms of harsh sentencing? And then particularly to wrap it all in an otherwise blameless life. I mean, you mentioned the young lady who got 5 years. I mean, this is why I have, like, quite the ambivalent approach to this, because, you know, this is a system that if we advocate for harsher sentences, well, they're going to fall disproportionately on communities of color, right, on federal and state level. Like, that's a proven fact. Right. But at the same time, when you see it this blatant, it, you know, you have to step back and say, like, 47 months for, you know, 4 years, if he serves that much. It's a disservice, and it's certainly a disservice to anyone who is seeking a sense of justice. The collective American conscience, which is right now looking for closure. Like, I think we're getting to the point where we have Russia fatigue, and to see this guy get off with 4 years when everyone else around him sentenced by the same judge, let's get far more than that. It's really a slap in the face.
Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting because the in the years running up to the Trump election, right, there was a lot of people in sort of our sector, if you will, of political commentary who were pointing out that there's a tremendous disparity in the way that justice is being meted out in this country. Taibbi had a book. Greenwald had a book. In many respects, Dayan's book was largely about that. In the wake of the financial crisis, this dynamic where if you are a millionaire hedge fund or billionaire hedge funder, or if you're the one who's profiting off of all of these mortgages and these foreclosures, you're fine. If you're Steve Mnuchin, you're fine. If you are a lower income or middle income, and you went in and you were basically just trusted your bank loan officer that this is the way that things are done, you got screwed. And this is a problem. I mean, and on some level, the idea, you know, to the extent that there is a problem in this country with discouraging corruption at the highest levels, right, of our society, this does not help. Now, all of this also begs the question of, like, why did it take so long? Like, you know, why, if Donald Trump was not elected president, Paul Manafort would be sitting in one of his 12, you know, pieces of property, wherever he had, you know, drinking, you know, water out of his fur-lined sink or wherever he was doing with all that cash. You know, nobody would know that Donald Trump was in the money laundering business. Nobody would know that he made his fortune through tax evasion, just like Paul Manafort. Nobody would know. I mean, all of this, None of this would have been, nobody would be digging into this. These guys would be living the life if Hillary Clinton was the president right now.
Uh-huh.
And that uh-huh. is also, I think, highly problematic.
Yeah. Yeah. What the facts, right? And I think that there's a certain point where Donald Trump is probably relenting, like just really hating the fact that he became president almost every day, notwithstanding the responsibility that he is not up to the task to meet, but just the sheer reality that by winning the presidency, he has now brought and shined a light on all of his criminal past, all of his fraudulent past in that way. But you were saying, I just want to say one last thing in terms of the justice system. I think one of the biggest differences, and it's something that I'm learning now, the biggest difference really is who can afford to pay the right attorneys. And we see so many times, like, you know, when the young lady, I don't know her legal situation. I don't know what kind of attorney she had that was sentenced for 5 years for voting in the wrong place. You know, when you're going up against this justice system and you're going up against the attorneys that they have, and you're not equipped financially to fight back with your own attorneys, then you are going to get, you know, the harshest sentence that they can get on you, you know. So I think one of the biggest downfalls of our system is just the inability to have proper representation across the board. I mean, our public defender system, while, you know, noble, it is surely inadequate when you're going up against a system that is funded by all of these billions of dollars in order to get the harshest sentences possible. And you look at a Steve Mnuchin, you look at a Paul Manafort, you know, part of the calculus here probably was just the fact that he could afford some of the best attorneys he could possibly get to fight back against all these charges and get a reduced sentence, an obscenely reduced sentence. So I think all that goes into play into the system of injustice and the inequity and justice in this country.
Well, yeah. And not only has there been a tremendous rollback in funding for criminal defense attorneys who are doing, you know, pro bono work or public defenders. And we're starting to hear now Republicans talk about, and even on the court, actually, the Supreme Court, there's a couple of justices who have started to hint at the idea that, like, I don't need that, know that we need to provide this for people. That is even more reason why we need statutory criminal justice reform, so that,
right,
you know, regardless of the type of representation you have when you come into court, that there is no opportunity for you to go to jail for 5 years for being under the impression that you could vote when you couldn't vote.
Right.
You know, it's one thing, we've uncovered a massive scheme to drive undocumented immigrants from the Massachusetts area in right. 75 buses and interdisperse them throughout New Hampshire so that we could sway the vote. I mean, aside from
the Veritas Project, it'd be different if the Veritas Project was true, right?
Exactly. Right. But you know, when you're talking about one person who goes in and thinks that they're allowed to vote, one way you deal with that is, like, everybody can vote. So you cannot right. make a mistake about whether you are eligible. There's no reason for there to be these Byzantine laws about if you've served or if you're on probation, et cetera, et cetera. All right. Let me just, I know you got just a couple of minutes left, but there's two things that I want to talk about. And I want to get your take on either one of them. And I'll give it to you as your pick. One is Warren came out with a plan today to break up Facebook, Google, and Amazon. Or also, I think this is interesting because of just the, I don't need to tell you why it's interesting in terms of the narratives that are out there, but there was a morning consult poll, I think it was on Wednesday maybe, that was released that said Bernie Sanders is leading all other announced candidates in support from black voters. I think, and in terms of unannounced, I think Biden may be slightly ahead of Bernie, but the operative thing is that Bernie supposedly, it seems to undercut the narrative that Sanders does not appeal to African-American voters. Your choice on either those topics, or if you want to do both, we can do that too.
Oh man. Okay. Let's take the low hanging fruit. Let's take the Bernie Sanders and the black vote for 200. My take is really this, like, we, you know, Sanders, does appeal to Black Americans. But here's a problem. The specific set of Black people who participate, number one, in the primaries, right? Number two, who participate in the South, you know, I really would want to see it drilled down to primary voters, because if he's going to win, he's got to win in the primaries,
right?
And he's got to clean up shop through the South. And so while I know nationally, you know, I'm one of his supporters, I've been a supporter since 2015, probably before that. The fact of the matter is, it's like there's a certain level of there's a certain approach, there's a certain means of communication. And there's certain pitfalls that he just should not stumble himself into, unforced errors when it comes to the Black vote, particularly primary voters. So while we can easily say Bernie is popular amongst Black people, yes, he is. How popular is he amongst the Democratic base of primary voters that really, for God knows why? Well, I mean, I know the answer. Biden, you know, you think of Biden, you think of Obama, you think of the good old years. I get it. And I just, for the life of me, I don't know why they would support Biden. But if you look at those primary voters, that's the reason he's not announced that he might be ahead, or he is ahead of Bernie Sanders. So, you know, it's not just about the general election. It's about that primary base of Democratic. I mean, the people who actually go to the convention, you know,
right.
Those are the folks that that Sanders has always had a problem with. And I think that's where he's going to have to do his best work and not have a bunch of unforced errors.
Yeah. And I think that, I mean, the campaign clearly understands this, right? I mean, he made a point of right after he announced, saying to, you know, leaking an email he sent to all surrogates, treat the Democratic Party with respect. And as a means of appealing to those Democratic primary voters, he did his, you know, swear to allegiance to the Democratic Party the other day or whatever that document was. And,
yeah.
And, you know, I think there's, I think it's Jamelle Bouie who's written that, you know, those, folks, African-American folks you're talking about have a lot of reason to look at the, to want to protect the institution of the Democratic Party because of its history in things like the Voting Rights Act and things like the Civil Rights Act. And go ahead.
I mean, and to be fair, like it's rather transactional for quite a few of them. Some of the power players in the Democratic Party, African-American power players, they have a transactional relationship with the Democratic Party. Like it has been a means to success and opportunity and platforming. And so, I mean, I think it's unreasonable for people on the outside to look at people who have this allegiance to the Democratic Party and say, oh, you're not doing what's in your best interest. You should be voting for Bernie if you knew what was in your best interest. Well, no, these people actually do quite know what's in their best material interest. And it has been working with and through and around the Democratic Party for years. So I think a part of Sanders' release saying respect the Democratic Party, you know, or at least, you know, play nice. I think that's a baseline that a lot of Sanders supporters, you know, it's a hard pill to swallow. But, you know, if you want Sanders to win, you can't win it through a scorched earth war against the Democratic Party, particularly Black folks in the Democratic Party, because they really do hold the keys to the power, particularly through the South in the primaries. So, you know, it unfortunately, it just is what it is.
And I would also say that not only has there been success transactionally for a lot of, you know, let's say the Black community leaders within the Democratic Party, and material benefits for Black people, you know, across the board in terms of some, you know, key Democratic measures, obviously, you know, with obvious limits and whatnot. But
right, for sure.
I think the other thing that people need to understand is there's not a lot of other paths. Right. Like,
right.
Like, you know, the Democratic Party has been helpful to the African-American community to a, you know, within certain limits. But it's not
absolutely.
But there's not like there's a lot of other institutional outlets for
right.
For progress for yeah. the African-American community. And that's not a function of the Democrats. That's a function of America.
Right, for sure. My I can't really call him a friend, but we're friendly. Bakari Sellers from CNN. When I had a quote unquote debate slash interview with him some years ago, and one of the things that he was excited about was this proposition of Bernie Sanders starting continuing his revolution after the election, particularly because of the amount of support that it would provide for people who would like to be progressive and go further to the left, but can't because of the lack of opportunities to have a support base, a financial support base, to actually create a platform that you can work in and work through. So, I mean, it's not only that the Democratic Party has been the primary platform for African-American leaders to be propelled into the national spotlight, but it's also the fact that there's still room for more platforming to occur. But unless it is created and it has unless we have the ability to pump people through a system, almost like the right-wing media machine does, take a person, plug them in, and they're platformed and they have success. Until we start creating that type of infrastructure politically, you're going to continue to see people go to the Democratic Party. It only makes sense. I quite honestly don't understand why people can't see that there has been material benefit and that these people are working in their best interest. And it could fall back. I'll say this, and it's not a dig against Sanders, but it could fall back to one of the primary issues that I have with Bernie Sanders. With the debate he had with Hillary Clinton, when he referenced black people growing up in, you know, basically in the hood. I'm paraphrasing because it's been years, right? But it's this perception that all black people fall into the same class category. And you have to understand there's quite a few wealthy middle class, upper middle class African Americans, quite a few of them who have gotten this benefit from the Democratic infrastructure, and they continue to get it. So if you can't put that in your calculus, then you'll continuously be referring to black people as a impoverished monolith. When in reality, that's far from the case. And the people that you need to win in the South in the primaries are part of that upper middle class, well-to-do black Democratic Party operatives. You know, you have to not burn the relationship. You may not have a friendly relationship with them, but if you want Sanders to win, you can't go through the South and just throw them aside.
I will just say this. I sat on a panel years ago on the weekend show with this guy. I think it's Peebles. I can't remember who it was. He was I think he's one of like Forbes' wealthiest African-American, you know, entrepreneurs in the country. I don't know if he was involved with BET. I can't remember. I didn't know this until afterwards because we got into a big argument about the estate tax. And he was telling me that the CBC, the Congressional Black Caucus, was in favor of relaxing the terms for the estate tax. And I was like, OK, but that's fine. But it doesn't make it right. And he was arguing tooth and nail. And I didn't realize he was one of the big multimillionaires. Yeah. And so
we're not all broke, man. Well,
I didn't realize you were a multimillionaire, but I will keep that. I will mark that down in my on my phone when we're looking for a new membership level of the Majority Report. All right, Ben. Thanks so much for your time today, man. I really appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
Ben Dixon of The Benjamin Dixon Show. Talk to you later. Thanks, Mike. There he goes. He had to go at one, and he was literally going. All right, before we go into the fun half, I want to talk about this Warren proposal, because we have talked about in the past the idea of how would you break up these big companies? And at the time, I think these big tech giants, and at the time I said, like, I don't know. I know there is a way. And there are policy, there's policy apparatus that are working on this. And at the very least, this is, I think from anti-monopoly folks and antitrust folks, they would say this is a very measured, somewhat moderate proposal. I think Matt Stiller made a point on Twitter about the Sherman Antitrust Act actually having criminal liabilities as well. But Warren announced the proposal, I guess today she's announcing it, and it calls for the appointment of regulators who would unwind tech mergers that illegally undermine competition. And it would also, and this is sort of consistent with the Sinn Féin laws that we used to have, the syndication laws, which first, I think, came from movie theaters back in the early 1900s or mid-1900s, where you could not be a movie studio and own movie theaters. And the reason was because, obviously, you're going to favor your own movies in these movie theaters. You're going to crowd out the competition of other people making movies. And so, and then we saw this in television as well. Bill Clinton rolled this back in the Telecommunications Act of 1996, where studios, NBC studios, could not sell to NBC television. Because obviously they would be incentivized to only put on projects made by NBC television. And now, you know, the theory, I guess, was that, well, and it was problematic for several years. And then I think cable basically opened it up quite a bit. The reason why you got that Union Cafe show that Jim Fallows did was a perfect example of, like, what happens when NBC produces its own shows. Garbage. I was offered it, but let's not get it there. All right, so here's the point. She is proposing that you cannot have a platform that both offers a marketplace for commerce and participating in that market. So, for instance, Amazon Marketplace cannot, every time you search for something, provide you with something that is an Amazon, either an Amazon product or something that has been promoted by Amazon. Right? So, because Amazon now is the number one search function for products. People don't go to Google when they want to buy a hamper for their apartment. They go to Amazon and they buy a hamper, and then Amazon pushes the product that they have the most financial interest in. That's problematic. On YouTube, if it's going to be a marketplace for videos, should not be promoting products or video products that they have a financial incentive in. You cannot be both the distribution mechanism and also a supplier to that mechanism. I mean, this is what net neutrality is about. Fundamentally, the idea that Verizon has the pipes that they're sending to your house, and they cannot disadvantage competitors to what goes through those pipes to what they are sending through the pipes.
Sorry. How's that going to work with Facebook? Because the product there is your personal information.
Well, it would force the rollback of some acquisitions by Facebook. So their deals for things like WhatsApp and Instagram or Amazon's addition of Whole Foods and Google's purchase of Waze are examples of what they would do to unwind these things. Companies would be barred from transferring or sharing user data with third parties, which is everything that Facebook is, right? I mean, that's Facebook's model. So those are the major elements of this. And what would happen in terms of, like, how they would determine on some level which companies are subject to what level of scrutiny and regulation, Warren's plan creates two tiers of companies. Those that have an annual global revenue of $25 billion or more, and those that with an annual revenue of $90 million to $25 billion. The upper tier would be required to structurally separate their products from their marketplace. Smaller companies would subject to regulations, but would not be forced to separate themselves from the online marketplace. So you could have smaller entities. And the thing is, you know, what is the what is their product on Facebook? Right, it is like the data, and
it's you.
That's it,
and it's you. And so you can't both collect this data and monetize it in the way that Facebook would want to and remain that big. And so There may be other proposals that are released to this. Hopefully, this is one of those situations where, like, Warren again. And I saw a quote where Faz Shakir, who is now the campaign manager for Bernie, had said just weeks ago before he was appointed the campaign manager that Warren seems to be winning in the marketplace of ideas in terms of rolling out new policies. Bernie's not quite there yet in terms of like starting to introduce new policies. Of course, many of his old policies have now been adopted by everybody in the field, which is great.
Trendsetter.
But, you know.
Also, Faz Shakir, first Muslim appointed to manage a campaign.
Indeed. But, you know, it's always what have you done for me lately is in this business, as it were. But
and also in Eddie Murphy.
Right. I mean, largely that's what happened like with Woody Allen with this comedy. Like you watch a Woody Allen movie now and it's like, oh, all these jokes are old. I hear these everywhere. And it's because they all were basically derived a whole generation of comedy writers.
Yeah, that's my issue with watching Woody Allen movies.
There's
now
other tangential issues. And to be honest, I haven't watched one in a long time. But that's
that literally is my issue with Woody Allen. He's not funny.
Well, there you go. Well, I don't want to get too sidetracked by
Woody
Allen.
Let's get
here.
Back
the point
to Warren.
Is Warren, but so this is great. I mean, this is exactly in a perfect world. The only thing that's different in a perfect world from this one, where we are seeing candidates try to outdo each other with making government a tool to do good. And empower citizens, not as consumers, but not just as consumers, as citizens, because much of this has to do with democracy as much as it does has to do with material benefits for people. And we should understand that material benefits for individuals is not just a function of you as a consumer. When you have this type of concentration of wealth, there's two things that happen. One being that you lose political power, or they gain too much political power, but also the economy becomes far less dynamic and you get far less development of new companies. And new companies provide more opportunities for people, both in terms of wage increases and in terms of just, you know, opportunity to spread the wealth. So this is encouraging to see this stuff. And this is stuff I feel like Warren would have rolled out 2 years ago if Clinton had been named president. And she would be just championing this in the Senate.
Yep. She's going to make a great SEC chair under President Bernie.
Precisely. Or Treasury Secretary.
Or just be in the Senate and get these proposals in.
That's true. I mean, she will be, if she stays in the Senate, she'll be one of the great senators. I mean, that's a given.
All right, we're going to take a quick break, head into the fun half. Folks, you could join us in the fun half. Once you become a member of the Majority Report, you can become a member of the Majority Report by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. And when you do, your pennies a day, you're like 50 pennies a day, support the free show and gets you all access. Now, again, I've said this before, you just got to have patience with us because, you know, emails back up. But if you are in a financial position where you cannot afford a membership, send us an email. We'll work out a deal with you at majorityreporters@gmail.com. We don't ever lock anybody out for finances. So check us out there. And don't forget justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. I visited Just Coffee a couple of weeks ago when I was in Madison for a wedding. And I went with my buddy, Stephen Sherrill, who is a producer emeritus of the Majority Report from back in the radio days. And Stephen tends to get excited about things, like worked up about certain things. But he was so adamant for the rest of the trip, like, I would have bought their coffee anyways, but now I feel like it's completely disgusting for me to buy my coffee anywhere else. They're such a great company.
That's kind of true, though.
It is
like,
true.
That sounds melodramatic, but it's correct. That is the right opinion.
It was a fascinating conversation I had with a couple of guys, and just in terms of their relationship with the farmers and what they're willing to basically just what their values are, you know? I mean, just it was very, very impressive. And the outfit was also pretty impressive. And looking at a roaster, I'd never seen a coffee roaster before. So justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY to get 10% off. Today is Friday, which means that Tuesday was Tuesday. What happened on Tuesday, Michael?
Ben Burgess, Logic for the Left. We ran a clinic on how to debate and win. Also, Bernie's launch and Lula's visit to his grandson's funeral. This Sunday, illicit history of Caribbean debt, dependency theory, and Marx with Tamanisha John from Florida International University. And get your tickets to LA Live Show. We're halfway sold out, and we're real close. We're still several weeks out from the date. If I might do, is it okay? I'll just do this a side plug having nothing to do with me or the show. Please listen to Mehdi Hasan's interview with Cornel West, a reminder of why he's like the best public intellectual we have alive.
Hell yeah.
Jamie, what's up on the Intifada?
I'm so glad you asked. This week on the Intifada, we speak with Hamilton Nolan of Splinter News, formerly of Gawker, about media organizing, union organizing in general, the current landscape for labor in the U.S. and beyond. And we have a bit of a back and forth about whether we need to reform the current labor institutions or whether we need a whole new paradigm. Also, if you haven't listened to it yet, our interview with Kim Stanley Robinson, the utopian sci-fi hero from last week. We let Will Meneker sit in on it because he's a huge nerd like us who loves his books. It made me feel hopeful for the first time in a while. So if that doesn't get you, I don't know what will.
Matt, what's happening on the Literary Hangover?
What's happening is listeners are subscribing to it on YouTube, Literary Hangover. Coming up is going to be an episode on King Philip's War and the captivity narrative of Mary Rowlandson.
Captivity narrative.
That's next week, though.
All right, great. We're going to take a quick break. Head into the fun half. 646-257-3920 is the number. See you there.